Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Back Half podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
Today we are going to talk about a harrowing incident in both Kate and mine's lives over the past week, which was watching the 1984 BBC TV film Threads, in which nuclear apocalypse comes to Sheffield. We'll be joined by Jude Rogers, who's writing about that for us for the magazine. Usually I try and get Claire, my wife, to come and watch these things with us, but I actually made her stay in the study.
So you knew it was going to be
about
as bad?
About half an hour in, Claire wandered in and said, shall I join you? And I said,
No, maybe not. I watched it on Friday night, which is the most depressing thing. So I was in bed with a laptop between, like, I think 10 and midnight on Friday. So it kicked off the weekend. I think I was drinking soup from a cup. I was like, God's sake, why do you do this to yourself?
But then to cheer ourselves up.
Oh, we went to see I, Tonya last night in a very, very small screen, considering it's an Oscar-nominated film, in a cinema that's currently being refurbished.
And cinema has... Leicester Square. I did think, like, what, as a tourist, you kind of come to London's Leicester Square to catch the latest movie, and then it was just...
to get tarpaulins.
Lined with cardboard and tarpaulins.
This is the one that used to be the Empire, the great big premiere one. And yeah, it's just been covered in crap, but they can't afford to close it while it's being refurbished. So it's just business as usual. So yes, so this is the film for which Margot Robbie is nominated for Best Actress. And it's the story of Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, ice heroes of the early 1990s, something that didn't really make its way through to Britain, perhaps, as it did in America, where it was a huge scandal and a source of much national gossip.
And finally, we will have our non-anniversary as usual, but you'll have to listen on to find out what that's about.
So we have a very special guest in our mouldy basement this week. Jude Rogers
Hello.
Is here with us. Hello, Jude.
It's very appropriate being in a mouldy basement, surrounded by things that could possibly, block out nuclear fallout, or maybe not.
That's true. We could probably construct an inner core or refuge from these cardboard boxes.
Yeah, here. There's a cardboard box leaning up at a 30-degree angle at the moment against the wall. All this being, of course, because Jude has been working on a long read for us, which is coming out on March the 2nd, about Threads, which is the famous and only screened twice on terrestrial television vision of the nuclear apocalypse by Mick Jackson that was put out by the BBC in 1984. And Jude has been digging through the fallout to find out about the making of this show and all the background and everything that led towards it. So, I mean, what was your knowledge of this programme growing up? Because this was a kind of legendary thing and people couldn't see it, could they?
Yeah, so I was six in 1984 and I didn't see it. I came across it like sometime in the late 90s, probably some evening in a friend's house. A friend had got a, three times taped VCR copy of it or something. I didn't have all of it. I remember just seeing the first, half an hour of it. And basically it starts in a very recognisable kitchen sink drama fashion. The script's by Barry Hines, who famously wrote Kestrel for a Knave, which was adapted into Kes, which might give you some clue that all might not end well. But it's set in Sheffield. He's from North Yorkshire. And the rhythms of the language are just you're in there. You're absolutely in there. You're with, you know, you're basically being taken through the lives of some families who have, you know, gone through their own domestic dramas. But in the background, the radio keeps playing and you keep seeing newspapers in shops with headlines. And obviously something's going on internationally that nobody's really paying attention to. And when I was writing this piece, I thought, right, I'm going to check how many minutes in the bomb actually goes off, which is 46 minutes. And it's so excruciatingly tense and slow. And you know what's coming. But you're just watching these people getting on with their lives and starting to notice, you know, there's one point, the daughter of the Kemp family, which is one of the families, puts a glass of milk down, just looks at the radio. There's little chilling moments like that. And obviously more chilling now than it was maybe 10, 15 years ago, because, you know, you think of your own lives now. You know, I think in the mornings when I'm preparing my son's Weetabix and I've got Radio 4 on in the background, and I'm going, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been a fun January and February writing this piece, you know, in the darkest time of year with lots of exciting news headlines. It's been very jolly.
What do we know about the political kind of events that led to the, you know, for instance, you mentioned in your piece the Panorama episode that was talking about the Protect and Survive films, which in fact were not broadcast, were they, the Protect and Survive films?
No.
The famous ones we all know about yeah. You know, you leaning a door up and covering up your bodies and stuff.
Yeah, so kind of very telescope version. They were made in 1975.
So these were public information films.
They were
films.
Public information films made by Richard Taylor Animations, a company loads of us who grew up in the 80s, 70s, 80s will remember. They did Charlie Says. They did lots of beautiful, quite, you know, strangely eerie kind of public information films. You know, at the time, I interviewed one of the animators on it, which was very exciting finding him. You know, he was very young when he did the Protect and Survive films, only 27. And he was looking at, you know, was basically knew that they had to translate the messages they were given from the COI very simply for every audience, because if they were shown, this was going to happen or this was very likely to happen. So 1975, you know, is a strange time because obviously we're still in the midst of the Cold War. But the Civil Defence Corps was disbanded in Britain in 1968, and these films were made and sent around the country to local government commissioners. So there was a recognition in that, you know, there had to be something just in case, but there wasn't any real architecture, any structure beyond that to support that. The Panorama documentary, If the Bomb Drops, that was made in late 79, early 1980, explore that issue of the lack of civil defence kind of plans if this could happen. And this was made not long after Reagan was elected. Its editor, Roger Bolton, who I interviewed for the piece, had been in America. They'd made a programme called Rearming America. And he'd start to think about the implications of this, of Reagan's plans for military expansion within the UK. Obviously, you know, missile bases. And as we go on through the early 1980s, you know, again, I don't remember the time, but I remember images on TV of, you know, Green Common, obviously, and just these news events in the background, which is, I think, why it makes watching Threads now really chilling, because if you're of a generation, if you're in your 30s, 40s, because it's this vague memory that's crystallising in a different way now. In March 1980, the films were shown for the first time on If the Bomb Drops.
They were leaked, right? I mean, these weren't designed to be shown only in case of an impending or imminent nuclear attack.
Absolutely. Roger McIntosh, the animator, signed the Official Secrets Act. I spoke to Roger Lim from the Radiophonic Workshop, who I mentioned briefly in the piece, and he had to hand over the jingles in an alley. You know, it was all very secretive, incredibly secretive.
The scary, spooky jingle sound.
Yeah, but I had it confirmed by the team, the Panorama team, that a local government commissioner had leaked these to the producer.
And a 29-year-old Paxman presented
29-year-old Paxman.
Panorama.
It was kind of very strange just watching very young Paxman. What strikes me as really interesting, and is a kind of thread, no pun intended, through the piece, is a lot of the people making these films, documentaries, were pretty young. Mm. Paxman was 29 and presented, he goes around the country, there's a bit where he's in a helicopter talking about the effects of a bomb. Robert Harris was one of the researchers on it, who was quite young himself, in his 30s. Roger Bolton was in his mid-30s. So, you know, relatively young. And one thing I thought was really interesting that Roger Bolton said was, you know, this was a new generation that had grown up after the Second World War, so weren't like members of the government or structures of power at the time, who still thought of, you know, we must listen to authority, we must do what these disembodied voices tell us, you know, to to do this. They were saying, no, we're children in the 60s. Mm. We want to ask questions. And there had been this growing distrust of government and various structures in the 70s, which led to this kind of bravery within the BBC, which, again, is quite interesting when you think of the BBC yeah. now and what the, you know, the BBC is still making great documentaries. But then there was a real, a more of a tension about it. And the BBC did lots of, you know, the BBC decided to broadcast these Protective Survive films, which were, you know, they shouldn't. They were could have been locked up.
And they were incredibly, the thing that struck me watching them for the first time, I watched them when we discussed the animated film When the Wind Blows on this podcast a few weeks ago. And on the DVD extra, they have the full Protect and Survive series. And I watched them and it's incredibly specific. It starts with building these shelters, which is what you'd expect, but then it goes through, it kind of goes through to the logical conclusion to what you do with your dead family member, yeah. how you cover them with plastic, how you write their name and address and
wrap them in polythene.
Yeah. And then if they've been in the house for more than 5 days, yeah. remove them to a patch of earth outside and, you know, cover them with earth and await further identification.
Mark the grave.
Yeah. So it's kind of presented obviously very coolly and calmly in a kind of don't panic best of British style, but increasingly horrific as the series goes on.
The thing that struck me was the destabilizing thing about the way Threads is made is that you have the drama unfolding and then you have these punctuations of this clipped government kind of voice, as Tom says, delivering hopeless messages in quite a rational way. So you get the entire peacetime resources of the British Health Service would be unable to cope with even the single bomb that has hit Sheffield.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, was Threads a protest film, basically? Was it something that was just saying there is nothing we can do?
It was absolutely a protest film. You know, Mick Jackson made that very clear.
Mick Jackson, who made The Bodyguard.
Mick Jackson made The Bodyguard. That was one of the most exciting things I found out very early on, because I was obsessed with The Bodyguard when I was, you know, 16. And my mother was in love with Kevin Costner. Yeah, this is very odd. So, it was absolutely a protest film. He was a science documentary maker for the BBC beforehand. He'd actually been recruited into the BBC just after the War Game was banned from BBC, which is the famous 1965 documentary about the effects of a nuclear bomb, which is the first film to really display in any meaningful, you know, and a very brutal way what could happen. Although the BBC didn't broadcast it, it won an Oscar a year later. But he entered the BBC in this atmosphere. But many years later, after if the bomb drops came out and there were no repercussions, there was a more sense of bravery within the BBC about tackling that issue. He made a QED in 1982 called A Guide to Armageddon, which is on YouTube. And if you're into any of this stuff, I'd strongly recommend watching it, because it is it really is an amazing foreshadowing of Threads, you know, this kind of dispassionate voice, just saying very simply and factually, this is what will happen. And he had to pitch it as, this is factual. This is, this is not political. Because one of the arguments against the War Game was it was political. And obviously it's the BBC. You can't be political. But he was very dispassionate. And then from that, they decided we need to do something more than this. So, Threads is absolutely a protest film. He was very much energised as well by a 1983 US film called The Day After, which is broadcast in America in November 1983, watched by 250 million people. And apparently by Ronald Reagan, who was like, oh, it's in a film. This is interesting. That is a very, a much more sanitised version of what happens in Threads. There are families going about their daily lives, but after the bomb drops, you know, there's a hospital that has working electricity, and this really angered Mick Jackson. So they were in pre-production already at this stage, but, you know, he wanted to show how, you know, how real it could be. And, you know, Threads is 2 hours, and it's relentless. Yeah. It's relentless.
Given you were talking about Mick Jackson's documentary background, just for those who don't know, can you just say something very briefly about the form of Threads? Because it is a kind of proto-docudrama form. It mixes the two media, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he set out to do that. He wanted to create a new form because he didn't like how The Day After was basically a made-for-TV disaster movie. Yeah. He said that was the worst thing that could be made. It had to be something that felt different, that pushed things on. And he was relied upon because he had this science background. You know, he had done an electronic engineering degree and then gone to film school. So he was trusted. He was absolutely trusted.
The bomb drops, what, 40, 50 minutes
46
in?
46 minutes, 30, I don't know. it's in the piece, I can't remember. And, but it feels a very long time.
And the rest of the film really shows in kind of scientific accuracy what the fallout from that event would be?
He'd done so much research, Mick Jackson. He'd spent a year doing research. He'd a list of like 45 to 50 experts that he talked to when he was talking to me on the phone about the film. You know, he'd gone to the first ever climate change conference, interestingly, in 1983, where the idea of the nuclear winter was first discussed. He was very much reading the writings of Carl Sagan and people like that around the time, you know, the people who were pioneering this kind of thinking. But yeah, those first 46 minutes feel very slow, but you're not halfway through the film at that point. And again, you get this these long scenes, you know, just very long, very quiet, apart from kind of a quietly whirling wind. And mainly you're following around Karen Meagher, who plays Ruth, who is the girl from the couple at the beginning of the film, Ruth and Jimmy, who are basically, you know, heavy petting in a car, and she gets pregnant, and they're going to get married, and there's this domestic drama. But after the bomb, we never see Jimmy. We last see Jimmy running. We'll see him again at some point. We never see him.
That's what really struck me about it. That it doesn't lean back on the sort of idea of friendships and trench humour and muddling through that you'd usually associate with a film about war. So obviously your house gets destroyed, you cling to those that you know, you muddle through and you follow a kind of group of people making a new life or something. It's totally relentless, isn't it? The moment the bomb drops, everything is gone. And you have people who are talking about, you know, curtains and dinner and stuff, suddenly having to sit next to dead bodies. And what really struck me about it was that the dialogue just drops. I mean,
Karen Meagher doesn't speak.
She doesn't speak. It's like mental illness has just, you know, destroyed her instantly. And she's just quiet and walking around like this kind of figure in this ravaged landscape. And that's it for the whole
film. The scene that always sticks with me is when she's just looking around and there's this woman holding a baby who's obviously dead and just staring at her. And it's just absolutely chilling. And one thing I found out writing the piece was Mick Jackson's wife was pregnant with their first child during the making of it. And interestingly, when the wind blows, which I also mention in this piece, which I know you talked about on a previous podcast, at the end of it, it's dedicated to the children that were born during the making of that. So these are people who are new parents thinking of the next generation. I think that's a really important part of the protest behind the film, really.
Although some aspects of the film naturally feel quite dated, I was amazed in a way by how much they achieved with what special effects they could pull together, because they do try to render what it would be like to be in a major city after a however many megaton blast this is. So you've got raging fires, you've got piles of rubble, and then you've got really grotesque and convincing skin makeup as well. How did they go about?
So that was a classic, you know, almost like BBC techniques. I interviewed Rita May, who's the mother of Jimmy, she realises her younger son isn't with them when they're making the shelter, and she screams Michael and the blast goes off. She had a face covered in gelatin and bran flakes, which she was like, I don't know, I met her up in Sheffield. I went up to Sheffield and I looked at, there's a famous scene where you see the moor, the shopping quarter in Sheffield, everybody running about and panicking and Woolworths blowing up. I was amused that Woolworths now has regeneration billboards on it. You know, obviously Woolworths is long gone. But I met her around the corner because she was doing something for Radio Sheffield in the BBC. And yeah, she was like, oh, that makeup, it was horrible. Horrible it was. She's 75, she's still on TV regularly. And as I say in the piece, you know, the fact that you vaguely recognise all these faces makes it even more scary. But they used lots of bran flakes and gelatin. Karen Meagher mentioned to me, you know, going into work, you know, at the beginning of the day, and there'd be a rail of clothes which had just been blowtorched.
Do you know how they did the bomb itself? Because even that was very effective.
So they filmed the scene in the Moor Quarter. Mick Jackson remembers it was very early in the morning. He couldn't pinpoint precisely when. And the bomb going off is stock footage, you know, just juxtaposing that with stock footage. The houses blowing up, there was a terrace street which was earmarked for demolition. And they basically asked Sheffield City Council, you know, could we do it? Yeah. But Sheffield City Council gave all the extras for the film. And part of the reason it was set in Sheffield was that Sheffield had recently declared itself a nuclear-free zone. And so obviously there's a Barry Hines link as well, him being from Yorkshire. So all those elements just came together really naturally. Mm. Also, you know, Sheffield's the centre of the country, industry, you know, so it's geographical location in the middle of Britain.
They sort of justify in the film why they've chosen Sheffield as the location, don't they? They say these are the things that would be of strategic importance to
Absolutely.
A nuclear hit, you know, industry, there's a military base near somewhere nearby, isn't there?
Yeah, the first bomb goes off of the RAF base. And also not having it in London, I think, has more of an impact.
Definitely.
Yeah. You know, you also have the class element that runs through threads. That's really interesting. You know, if we have a working class Jimmy and middle class Ruth sort of get together, and then there's these tensions about that. And, you know, the mum, the middle class mum, you know, kind of knitting for the baby. And, you know, later on, well, they don't come out of it very well.
Mm.
They kind of go into their proper shelter in their house because Jimmy's family just make mattresses against the wall. You know, they don't last very long either.
But, and there's also a class thing in the wartime controllers in their local government bunkers who are saying,
yes.
what's the point of giving food to people who are going to die anyway? And I just thought it was almost as chilling as the blast, how quickly the infrastructure of the country goes to shit.
Yeah.
And the roads are going to be jammed. You know, there's no electricity, there's no phone lines. And the same as with when the wind blows, there's a sense of no one is going to help you. There's no one out there who's going to actually pick up any of these pieces.
Yeah,
it was like the nuclear apocalypse taken to its absolute conclusion. I mean, even language kind of gets destroyed at the end. No one's speaking in an obvious way.
Absolutely. You know, it made me think as well, the last section of Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker, which was published in the late 70s, in which it's written in this language, which is, you know, you don't realise when you start reading it, but then it's kind of post-apocalypse and language is broken down. It feels medieval. And, you know, that was in the ether as well. Mm. So that's interesting. But
did it have any backlash in terms of, you know, things... For instance, we talked about Ghostwatch on the podcast a few months ago, that was seen as a sort of very tasteless, bad move by the BBC. Did it, you know, Threads must have frightened an awful lot of people. Was there any kind of, did they have to go on Bite Back and defend themselves or anything?
Well, I think because it was part of a dedicated night that was dedicated to looking at nuclear war. So the Threads was broadcast in September 1984. There was a programme after it called The Eighth Day, which was also another documentary. And then there was a panel, a political panel after it, which had Robin Cook on it and a couple of other people discussing the issues. So, and it'd been on the cover of Radio Times that week. Mm. And so it had been flagged up, so that kind of avoided the surprise factor, I guess. You know, people knew that they were going to be watching something bleak.
Yeah.
Mick Jackson went on Pebble Mill at one the next day with a beeper on his belt because his wife was due any day to have their baby. If anything can bring on labour, it's watching Threads. And he couldn't remember the details of that. And it's one of those things I just lost in the mists of time, sadly. But obviously there was response. The BBC were being very responsible about the broadcast of it, which I think, again, maybe going back to the war game in 1965, the fact that there was this shame, Mick Jackson said, that they didn't broadcast that because of the responsibility and the worry that an old lady would throw herself under a bus after watching it. You know, it was handled very... very well, you know.
Wasn't there somebody in the government at the time who'd said, we'd rather you didn't?
Like, yeah, absolutely. And that's why it wasn't. So there was that weight of responsibility. But it was, you know, the one thing that everybody seemed to say, you know, I was asking them, you know, what was the response? And, you know, it's just like, you know, nobody called me or said anything. There was just this silence. You know, Mick Jackson said every time he'd done anything on the BBC, you know, the phone would ring at the end. But he said nobody called him. And he was like, oh, that's a bit weird. And then he realised why. When he spoke to his friends later, they said, I was just sitting there kind of shell-shocked, really.
For anybody who's not seen it, which is a lot of people, I imagine, we'd never seen it before, it's actually being reissued on DVD.
Yeah, this is
beginning of April.
This is part of a sort of growing... you know, resurgence of these Cold War era artifacts, isn't it? When the Wind Blows was reissued, Threads is coming back on DVD in April. I don't know whether it's just a kind of trick of timing in that the right people are coming to the right age, or whether it is genuinely that it's chiming with a political moment in which we're starting to think about these things again.
I think it must be in some respects, and definitely. Well, Threads was first put out by an American company, Severin Films, which does lots of, you know, slasher and horror things, actually, which I think is interesting because it definitely uses horror movie tropes to kind of
and
get
the new reissue
across.
Is a horror company, isn't it? We know.
Yes,
that
is Severin.
Oh,
yeah,
that's Severin. Right, yeah. Simply Media in the UK put out their stuff, but they've added some. Karen Meagher's done a commentary, which is extra for the UK, and Mick Jackson has done one as well. But kind of, I bet when it was first on the table, the resonance wasn't as, you know, profound as it seems to be now.
Well, you can read Jude's piece in the New Statesman in the next week or so. Jude, thanks so much for coming in to join us.
Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, Kate, we went to see I, Tonya last night. Ryan Gilbey's reviewed it in this week's New Statesman. It's based on a true story, which I didn't know this story, and I discovered that when Margot Robbie, who plays the lead character, read the script, she also didn't realise it was a true story.
She's Australian, right?
Yeah, she's Australian. Yeah. Can you just briefly tell us the story?
Yeah, so it's the story of Tonya Harding, who was a poor American girl who became obsessed with figure skating from a very young age, kind of 3 or 4 years old, very controlling mother, sort of trailer park people, as they would say.
She grew up in Portland,
right? Grew up in Portland, and you know, there's a scene in the film where she's told that she needs a fur coat for ice skating. So you see her shooting rabbits and stitching the pelts together to make one. I don't know whether that was a tweaking of the truth, but it was quite an effective way of showing that she was not cut of the same cloth as these gazelle-like, perfect, bright-toothed women skaters that she was in the arena of. And throughout the film, there's a sense that she is not getting the scores that she should be for her incredible triple axels and her jumps, partly because she doesn't fit the bill of what America wants a female figure skater to be. So it's a class film. And it's also, I was thinking, it's kind of a horrible story told in an entertaining manner, because it's full of domestic violence and beatings. But it's shot in a way that, in one sense, it feels quite dated. I don't know if you've ever seen To Die For by Gus Van Sant, early 90s film, mockumentary. So you've got these kind of colourful characters, spleen splits in two, and somebody says, you know, oh, it didn't actually happen like that, it happened like this. So it's quite a playful way that it's made, but also it's a way that was fashionable at the time when the I, Tonya story was happening. So in a way, it's kind of quite a nice bit of history that they filmed it in that early 90s style, I think.
So it's just, tell us what's the key incident, because there is this, obviously, this rivalry, but then the reason why it became such a huge news story is...
The key incident is the kneecapping of Tonya Harding's key rival, Nancy Kerrigan, by a stooge hired or suggested by her husband, who was a violent man towards Tonya himself. And this kneecapping brought about the fall of her career, because she ended up getting blacklisted for it forever, and her bloke went to prison.
The form is, it made me realise how much I like that kind of to camera form. Actually, I haven't seen To Die For, shamefully, but it made me think of a cock and bull story, which I love, and like early Sex in the City and stuff like that. Also like the first season of House of Cards, which is great, which does that kind of Shakespearean thing of just addressing the audience. I heard Margot Robbie talking about this on the radio recently, and she's actually a co-producer on the film. So her and whoever else it was, the scriptwriter, whatever, were actually sort of auditioning directors. The thing they said to all of the directors is, how are you going to do these domestic violence scenes? Because as you say, that's a really strong, dark thread that runs throughout the film. She has this very, very abusive relationship with her husband, Jeff Galuli.
Sebastian Stan.
Yeah, he's played by Sebastian Stan. Like many abusive relationships, she keeps coming back to him, and it's it's played brutally realistically in a way. But the director, whose name I don't have written down.
Craig.
Fact check fail.
Craig somebody.
Yeah. Craig. We're on first name terms with the director.
We can't remember all the names.
We can't remember all the names. We're not primary school teachers. Craig said, look, I'd shoot them in this very real, you know, uncompromising way. But then, because you can't have a 2-hour film of domestic violence, I'll break them with these. I'll have Tonya Harding fighting back as good as she's given, certainly in the scenes with her husband. And B, I'll have her addressing the audience and breaking the fourth wall. And that's part of the reason they went with this director.
Yeah.
It's quite a bold move, but it works.
It works. It's also got this kind of rollicking, relentless soundtrack of really brilliant kind of, you know, 70s rock like Supertramp and stuff. And it's just kind of, we were thinking about the budget they must have spent on this soundtrack, because it's huge. It's just, it kind of overtakes the entire thing. Sometimes it's almost too much. You think, there isn't really a moment for that song, but here the opening bars or something.
Yeah, it gives it a zing. And also it kind of highlights, you know, part of the difference between Tonya and the other contestants is, you know, she comes on to, I don't know, ZZ Top or Bad Company or whatever, when they're all doing, I don't know what they're doing, Sugar Plum Fairy or something, you know. So she's very much pitched as the outsider.
It made me think about, most of my skating knowledge comes from Blades of Glory.
Yes.
The Will Ferrell movie. And his character, Chaz Michael Michaels, is seen, I can't remember what he's, is it I Love Rock and Roll or something, his opening song on the ice in that, or We Will Rock You or something like that. But basically, there are shades of that style and little elements of what the brilliant Tonya Harding did, because you get these sort of random arm movements that just seem to kind of go with the beat rather than to beat about the skating. Yeah. And of course, Chaz Michael Michaels is basically just stomping on the ice. He's just like moving one leg side to side, and everyone goes mad for it. But I love the idea that when she comes back into, she has lots of, you know, rises and falls with her career. And at one point her coach says to her, you know, you do have a second chance, no more heavy metal, no more blue nail varnish.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that somehow she would still have got away with demanding that heavy metal was going to be her music when she went out there. You'd think there'd be enough of a kind of structure of coaches around her to say, no, you have to be dancing to the Nutcracker.
What's interesting
is Joan Jett.
I mean, the film is based on, the script was based on interviews with all the real characters. So everyone sort of participated in this. And at the beginning, they have a text on the screen saying this is based on wildly contradictory accounts. So especially around the central event of the film, they have had to kind of negotiate between different, you know, contradictory things that they've been told. Do you think they managed that? Did they fudge it, or did you get enough of a sense of what happened to kind of satisfy you?
I got a sense, the only thing that I wasn't sure about was how much she had known of the planned attack, whether she was aware that, I don't know, whether the kind of violent part of the kind of action against Kerrigan was something that she'd been aware of. But to me, it helped not being sure, because it just gave a certain depth to her character and slipperiness, because she's not an easy person. Mm. Every time she gets something wrong on the ice, she blames her skates for it. Or her laces or something. She's always going up to the judges and saying, you know, well, in this film, she says, suck my dick to the judges. She's troubled because of this awful mother that she has. So she's always blaming other people for everything that happens to her. So in a way, you kind of want that ambiguity about how much did she know. And also, once the attack has taken place, I don't know if you noticed this, but she and her husband rise to this kind of very kind of sexy power couple who are going out and doing these press conferences and looking like nothing can touch them. At the very point where actually you'd think they'd be trying to skulk around a bit and apologize because of this event that happened to Kerrigan, but they're just like, that's when they come into their own. So you wonder then, maybe she did know. I don't know, she says she didn't, but
she does she does learn to sort of take control of the situation briefly, although it then kind of subsumes her again. The relationship with the mother is like, it's almost like something out of Stephen King or Hitchcock. Like, it's a horror movie relationship in some ways, because the mother is so abusive. I mean, she from the age of four, she's grinding Tonya into the ground, because her justification being that that's what will make her perform the best.
She says, "Mum, you made me believe that I only skate well when my life is shit."
Yeah.
I mean, that's an incredible thing to put on a child. You have to be unhappy. You have to be beaten.
Yeah. Well, there's an incident where she's beaten with a hairbrush, which is kind of widely confirmed. And then the really shocking incident in the film, which maybe I won't reveal, but it's certainly much more than a hairbrush that gets thrown at Tonya Harding. And you get these great cutaways to sort of fake interviews with Lavona. They're not Lavana, mother played by Alison Janney. And they're kind of almost like, Christopher Guest, The Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like something out of that.
She's another 90s
documentary. Yeah, she's a character out of that. She's got a parrot on her shoulder and she's there.
And an oxygen tank.
Yeah, yes. Reminiscing. But we should say something about Margot Robbie's performance because it is sort of incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a scene before one of her final competitions where she's trying to apply makeup and she's also crying at the same time. And it's an extended scene of what she can do to her face to pull that kind of skating grin, and then it just falls again and tears come out, and it goes on for about 10-15 seconds. I really thought that, I mean, I know that Alison Janney got Best Supporting Actress Oscar for Lavona's part, but actually I didn't think there was much.
Nominated for it, yeah.
I thought she'd won it.
Do you mean BAFTA rather than Oscar?
BAFTA, sorry.
Yes. Yeah, she's won it. Okay,
she won cool. it. Well I didn't done. Think there was like that much acting going on compared to Margot Robbie. And I think that particularly at the end, there's an amazing juxtaposition of her greatest skating moment and the boxing that she actually turned to afterwards. And the idea that, you know, you kind of think maybe an ex-skater is going to go into dressage or something like that. But you see with her, the kind of primal nature that she has, that actually it would translate to fighting or skating. And it's very, very effective.
The face scene is amazing. And it reminds me of one of my drama teachers at school whose only instruction was, try acting more with your face, which I think we found infuriating. But I think Margot Robbie really pulls it off here. It just made me want to say that although Margot Robbie trained for sort of 3 or 4 months in terms of like getting some of the skating skills for this, actually how they filmed the serious skating, the kind of the big jumps and leaps and all that, was by capturing her face. Through two different face replacement techniques. So there's this amazing VFX company, and you can watch a clip of this online. So some of it is traditional green screen. Some of it is Margot Robbie sitting in this kind of weird sort of space dome where they capture her face from 360 degrees all around her. And then it took them 3 months to then place that face on the stunt doubles throughout the performances.
So, so it's not just the old thing of filming the legs and then the head
not.
Going at a different speed.
It's so sophisticated, and you never, there's no doubt in your mind that that's Tonya, that's Margot.
And the skating scenes are extremely effective because she's got a combination of grace and real rawness and speed. And she's so fast, and it seems to be filmed very close up. And then at the end, in the credits, they play footage of the real Tonya Harding, and it's identical. And it's just, you know, it's funny because the triple axel is the famous move, and you think, well, what's that really about? And of course, they twirl around 3 times in the air and land. And it reminded me again of Blades of Glory. What is it called in that? The move they try and attempt, the Flying Lotus. That's only been attempted in North Korea.
Yeah.
And the problem is that often one of the skaters can have their head severed by the other person's blade. So again, it's this kind of mythology of this move that only you can do.
Well, indeed, I can't remember if I already told you this, but they could not find a stunt ice skater to perform the triple axel. So that is performed through CGI. There are only two skaters around who can do it at the moment. They're both in Olympic training and couldn't risk, you know, injury or extra. So it's, you know, I think something like 6 people have done it since Margot Robbie. So contrary to most other sports where you expect like incremental advances over the years as like training and drugs and equipment gets better, she was, you know, she was at the very pinnacle.
You wonder why they didn't just use the real footage of her doing it and put Margot Robbie's face on. It's worth watching, because I just thought, you know, what's the big deal about that move? But it is interesting. It's the speed of it, and they show it in slow motion, and it is basically a matter of twirling around three times before your foot touches the ice again.
That's astonishing.
So it's worth seeing for the triple axis.
So I, Tonya, is in cinemas from this Friday, whenever that is.
23rd.
You work it out. 23rd. for this week's non-anniversary, our non-significant anniversary of a cultural event, we are, what are we celebrating, Kate?
We are 22 years to the week since Michael Jackson was rudely interrupted by Jarvis Cocker at the 1996 Brits by Jarvis getting on stage briefly and shaking his cord-clad bum at the audience.
So I rewatched the clip last night, and it's quite amazing. Jarvis sort of gets up on stage. This is Michael Jackson is performing Earth Song, dressed in rags, wind blowing through his hair, all these sort of street urchin children clustered around him. Jarvis is backstage, decides this is all a bit kind of pompous and that he needs to puncture it, and gets up on stage. Clearly, once he's up on stage, doesn't really know what to do. So he sort of trots along the stage. Then he does this sort of bends over and does this little wafting gesture with his hands from behind his bum. Then he trots over to the other end of the stage, lifts up his cardigan, puts it down. And then the camera pans out and you think he's run off stage, but actually he makes his exit via, there's a sort of piece of stage work pyramid at the back, and he trots up to the top of the pyramid and is briefly illuminated in front of a big circular screen, you know, like ET style, showing, you know, starving Ethiopian children.
And I then trots that back bit. Down again.
I know, it's amazing.
That's even better than the ash shaking.
I know. It's very, very brief.
Was he manhandled off by a security guard?
He was sort of ineffectually chased by a couple of the dancers.
And the children.
One of the dancers accidentally gets caught in the sort of wind machine and has his costume blown up over his head, so you see his pants.
Oh, possibly the last time the Brits were interesting.
Yeah, it was. Shit. I mean, I also watched another period piece. I also watched the interview that Chris Evans did with him a couple of days after on TFI Friday. Jarvis is like down the line from his studio from his backstage before some gig up north, and you forget TFI Friday, like, Every minute and a half, there's just a cheer from a crowd of people drinking giant pints of Guinness. So the tabloids were very upset and very pro-Jackson and anti-Jarvis. The TFI audience were very, very keen. Interestingly, when Tracy Thorne wrote a piece for us about the Brits, she actually said that, looking back on it, she kind of felt uncomfortable about it, and that it actually touched on some of the more kind of boorish, laddish, like unpleasant aspects of
that
time.
This of course is the time that in the collective memory indie reigned, but Tracy was sitting on a table with Bjork and Tricky and various other
and
people.
And Massive Attack, yeah.
And Massive Attack, and had the thought, I think this is where the interesting music's being made, not over there on Blur's table and Pulp's table and Oasis's table. So it was, you know, even though it's felt like a kind of a protest against Jackson's overweening pride at the time, it was actually quite a boorish, disruptive thing to do as well. So it's funny how it's kind of gone down. I remember watching it and just finding it, a mixture of amusing and vaguely uncomfortable.
Yeah. And the one anecdote that's worth repeating from the Chris Evans interview is that Bob Mortimer from Reeves and Mortimer, Vic and Bob, who used to work for Peckham Council in the legal department, when Jarvis was taken to the police station, because he was arrested afterwards. Yeah, he was arrested. He was in the local police station at 3 a.m. Yeah, because they claimed that he'd like assaulted a child on stage.
Oh, right. That's ironic, nonsense, isn't it?
But Bob Mortimer apparently accompanied him and offered to like speak in his defence.
But
then
bail
was so
him?
Waylaid by a policeman asking for his autograph that he didn't really get anywhere. Meanwhile, outside, sort of Neil Morrissey and Martin Clunes are staging a mini Free Jarvis protest. So this is really the stuff of Britpop legend, isn't it?
22 years ago this week.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Back Half podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight. Thank you to Jude Rogers for coming in. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton. Do get in touch if you've got any suggestions for non-anniversaries or indeed anything else. I'm on Twitter. NS Podcast is on Twitter.
I'm not.
Kate's not on Twitter. She's unreachable. You can write to her via PO Box 392. No, you can't.
But
you
don't
can't
even, send it to the other
can't
Kate
even
Mossman.
Write to...
There are two Kate Mossmans apart from me. One is a stylist and the other one is a kind of eco-warrior from Winnipeg. so don't ever tweet them because
they get
upset.
Enraged. Do they get upset? Have they ever been in touch
with
you?
They're very patient, but they never get in touch with me. But yeah, they do. They do have to field it sometimes.
They're wading through the fan mail.
We will be playing you out with the wonderful tones of Pistol Jazz and their tune Godspeed.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.